Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, writer Chris Corbell talks about how he became an artist.
I am a government pre-law. I am the son of an attorney. I am the grandson of an attorney. And I will be honest with you, there is only one reason why I'm in this class. And that is because the professor has told me that if you write a full-length play, whether it is good, whether it is terrible, you will get a B. I had wanted to be an attorney because I thought attorneys, they had an impact on the world. But no attorney could do this.
Today on the show, writer Chris Corbell talks about his path in becoming an artist. Stay close.
Hey, this is Chris Corbell, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with Allie Gertz. Allie Gertz, by the way, she's been on the show before. She used to be known as the youngest person on my show, because when she first came on, she was 21. And her story, in fact, was called her 21st birthday. And how she got drunk at the Roosevelt Hotel and puked all over, I think it was Chris Pine or some, it was some like movie star. I forget who it was. Anyway, Allie Gertz, super funny and a super interesting girl. She's also a musician and she's so damn talented, man. I just adore her music. I love her voice. She's one of a kind. So go back, you guys, listen to the show with Allie Gertz last week. By the way, Chris, her story about a car accident that changed her life, it was so, at one point, gruesome, you know, because it was a very serious car accident. Obviously, it changed her life. You can tell me what you think.
Okay,
why would
someone lie about that?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, of all the things to lie about, that would be the last one.
I didn't purport to say that she lied about it. I'm just saying it was very gruesome. And I had another storyteller on the show, a girl named Sasha Rothschild, who writes for GLOW. She still writes for GLOW. And she talked about getting run over by a train. And you guys should go back and listen to Sasha.
Did that change your life?
Sasha Rothschild. Let me tell you something. As she sat in front of me and told the story, I got totally weak to my stomach. Like, my stomach was flipping. I got all hot and nauseous. Like, I thought I was going to pass out. I had to have her stop the story. And I'm like, go to the refrigerator and get my water. Like, I was passing out in front of her. It was so gruesome. Well, let me tell you something. Allie Gertz, it's pretty flipping gruesome as well.
Wow.
Yeah, so you got to go back and listen to that show. But not today, you guys, because today I am here with writer and speaking coach Chris Corbell, and he brings forth the topic, How I Became an Artist. And I think it's interesting because I know you're not talking about how you actually found the tools to be an artist, because you always were an artist, but you're talking about giving yourself the permission to be, right?
Which is a very big step in life.
Well, yeah. Because you're committing to being poor forever.
I mean, yeah, it's like being a monk.
Wait a minute. How is it like being a monk?
Monks take a vow of poverty.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just silence.
Well, that's true. Well,
which would be the opposite of what we're trying to do.
That's true. If you had a monk on this show right now, it'd be just very, very quiet.
Maybe I should get a monk. I never had one.
Well, you can get one, but if they're taking a vow of silence.
Oh, it's going to be a quiet show.
Well, you can fill in the space if you want.
Ladies and gentlemen, how I became an artist, it is interesting because, you know, when you grow up, especially, you know, you're growing up, well, wherever you grow up, whether it's the Midwest or the East Coast or the West Coast, you know, you grow up in a family and you see how it's kind of supposed to be. You know, like, I'm the youngest of six and the sixth person to go to the same college. I went to the same school my sisters and my brother went. Well, so I knew the path. I didn't even you like apply to other schools because I just knew I was going there. And then each of my sisters got married and got real jobs and moved to the suburbs because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
that
like
was
the game
path.
Of life when you're a kid.
Yeah. You put those little people in your car, spin the wheel.
Yeah.
And anyway, so the point is that it took me a very long time, you know, to actually say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I could just, you know, use the skills that I have and even get better with them and then get money for that.
And isn't that the best?
It took me, though, you know, I'm doing my solo show coming up on
February 16th. It's a great show if you haven't seen it. Yeah. Folks, go catch it.
Coming up on February 16th, Surviving the Ride. And it's kind of about that in terms of, like, I became a flight attendant and then I went into the Peace Corps. Like, neither of those things were really what I should have been doing. But it's just this path you take because I knew it was a good job and I knew the Peace Corps was safe because it was organized. And, you know, you just follow this plan. And I knew it would be adventurous. And so I did that until I was 31. And I had to, like, you know, you saw my show. I had to get through the whole illness thing to realize, oh, wait a minute. Maybe I have a tangible skill that I could share. And it's interesting because I do feel like I have a tangible skill. And I do speak at events. I'm doing Podcast Movement coming up here in LA. And I speak at different things. And
Podcast Movement, what is that?
That's Podcast impressive. Movement is a massive convention that they do every year. It's massive. Every year it's in a different city. I was in the one in Philadelphia and there was Orlando. And now they're doing it's like a halfway through. The next one isn't until August, but they're doing one here in Los Angeles in February called Evolutions. And it's kind of like a Podcast Movement mini, but it's the same organizers. It's the same parties. It's really fun. So I'll be speaking at that. I spoke at the one in Philadelphia. So I do, my point is that, you know, it's still a, it's always a journey. It never stops because all the jobs end, whether it's one day or, you know, I had a TV series for 2 years, but it still ends.
Yeah.
So you have to, if you accept to be an artist, you have to realize that you're going to be constantly reinventing not just who you are, but like the, you know, you have to be able to handle not knowing what's going to happen. And that some years you get health insurance and some years you have to get Medi-Cal. And some years, you know, you can do this and some years you can't. So it's tricky.
It's for everyone else's benefit. That's the great thing. I've heard those stories you've told on your show. And even while you're suffering and just making some very bad choices or having bad choices inflicted upon you, it's so damn entertaining. So I'm really grateful that you have misspent and made bad things happen to you and have had a bad thing.
No, I'd rather, listen.
Because it's given me at least a good 2 hours of solid entertainment. No.
Listen, I know what priorities are. I've dated very wealthy people. I've seen a lot of money. And I realize that, like, even if you're, like, in Malibu, in the coolest place, and with all the money and all the great furniture, and you're looking out over the ocean, if you're not happy with the person in the house, if there's no joy there, you would rather be down on the beach barefoot with a can of Bud Light. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing about artists, right? We're all about that search for self-actualization.
Yes.
That search for meaning. I mean, we just can't read like a menu and just say, yeah, I'll have the omelet. It's more like, well, do I have the omelet with mushrooms or do I have it with bacon or do I have it together? What am I really saying with this order?
Well, I am anxious to hear your story because it's definitely a lifestyle choice. You know, it's, and sometimes I get a lot of anxiety, of course, about money, obviously. And, you know, am I making the right choice? And I think, you know, because I have a kid and everything, I think that, you know, I do want her to see, you know, somebody who's taking chances. You know, I do want her to see that. But I'd also rather have a huge house for her. You know what I mean? On the other hand, I'd like to get a new car.
I hear you.
So it's a challenge to choose being an artist every day because I really do have to choose it every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where your boss is yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I've done so many jobs, but, you know, I'm proud to be in LA for 22 years and never have had a real job, as it were.
You know, me too. I've been in this town for 26 years. I have had a few of those Joe jobs, but, you know, in the last 23, no. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're stubborn. Artists are stubborn people. I mean, if you really get down to it, I think what an artist does, not every artist, but the artists that you and I might like, is they tell everyone else what they think and what they feel. And people who know what they think and know what they feel are terrible employees in a lot of jobs. It really is. It's really true. I mean, God knows I've been on the receiving end of that in my life where I'm dealing with someone in their day job. And I know they're probably a really great actor, a really great musician. You know, I just want my coffee.
Yeah.
But I get it. I so get it. And, you know, bills have to be paid. But artists, you know, the job doesn't go to bed. You don't go to bed. You're always on the clock.
Always on the clock. I work a lot on Saturdays and Sundays. Those are like, I'll work like 6 hours each morning on Saturdays and Sundays because my daughter isn't with me and I have a lot of quiet time, you know? So it's just, but most people aren't working then.
Or you'll wake up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you're going to go like, I got to get it done now.
I usually don't wake up in the middle of the night and do it. I usually wake up early. Like I'll get up at 6 a.m. and my daughter doesn't get up till 7:30. So I'll do stuff in the morning.
Okay. You know? Well, then you'll get up 3 hours later than the middle of the night and do it. Yeah. The same concept.
Same thing. Well, anyway, listen, I'm super excited that you're here. And we're going to get to Chris's story in just a minute. But before we do, I wanted to remind you guys, you know what I want to remind you. So you know what? I'm not even going to say it. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Instagram and head over to storyworthypodcast.com. What? What are you talking about? Get on my mailing list, man. That's really what I want to say, because then I can bother you every week. No, I mean, I can entertain you every week with my artistic wit and humor. And I'll tell you when the next Story Smash is, which is February 29th. February 29th, it's a leap year. We'll be at the Hollywood Improv at 7:30. We sold out the other night. You were there.
Oh, that was an amazing show.
Amazing.
That was 10 kinds of crazy.
We sold out the month before. We've sold out like 4 or 5 months now in a row. Yeah, so it's really great, and it's going super well. So if you guys find yourself in Los Angeles, please come. Would you do that? All right, you guys, he's here right now. Chris Corbell. This is sort of interesting that you grew up in Manhattan.
I guess it's interesting. I mean, if you grew up in Manhattan, you don't know that it's interesting. Everyone else tells you.
I guess that you're from New York City. But then you moved to L.A. When did you move?
1993.
I got here in 97. And you got your M.A. in theater arts from Rutgers. Were your parents excited that you were going for a theater degree?
You know, actually, my mom was super supportive. I mean, my father passed away when I was very young. But my mom was super supportive. I think, actually, I'm really very lucky that I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which, if nothing else, is literally where a lot of artists live. So,
were you in a tall building?
I was in a very tall building.
What floor were you on?
I was on the 9th floor of a building that I guess must have had 18 floors or 20.
9th floor, man. Did you hear traffic?
You know, every so often there's an explosion that a truck makes when it backs off. But for the most part, you really don't hear that much.
What about the beeping sounds when people back up?
From 9 floors, you hear a little bit, not that much.
Yeah, not too bad. You probably get used to it.
Well, it's all you know.
Yeah, I guess so. Do you still have family back there?
I sure do.
Interesting. Well, actually, I know that you go back there a lot because you perform storytelling here in Los Angeles and also in New York City. And you have written a play, which is interesting.
I've written a couple, but
A couple of plays. Yeah. That's interesting. And you're a public speaking coach. What does that mean?
Now, there's a real difference between what I do and a lot of other people do. Because there's a whole division of public speaking where you're just dealing with executives and keynote speeches.
Yeah.
And then there's people who are giving speeches, but it's on the personal level. So maybe you're giving a wedding toast or a eulogy, or you're giving an anniversary toast or retirement toast. You're not a professional speaker, but you're in a situation where you have to speak professionally, or at least from the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's something I work with people on.
So people hire you, and then you sit down with them.
Yes.
Do you write it for them, or
no,
do you just
there's a
them?
Big difference between what I do, and I've had a partner who also works with them as well. I help them compose their thoughts. I help them get to the heart of what they're saying. My partner helps in the presentation, and that's together we bring out the best in a person.
Interesting. I've never met anybody that did that.
It's a niche industry, but in a town like Los Angeles, there are people who really invest in their public appearances. And
you're currently working on a full-length solo piece. You know I have a show. How long do you say is full-length?
Well, I think in this first development, it'll just be about 50 minutes so I can workshop it, and then eventually I'd like to get it up to an hour and 10.
That's what I want, just 1 hour. I want, because of course I want what everybody wants, the Netflix special. I want a 1 hour Netflix special. I think that'd be so great.
Your show is such a wonderful show.
Oh, thanks,
I cannot recommend it enough, folks.
That's
if you
so
get
sweet
the opportunity, you have to see it.
Wow, that's so sweet of you. You can find him over on Instagram at CKNYCLA. I get it, New York City, LA.
And on Twitter, I'm that T T-H-A-T, uh-huh. Chris Corbell.
And you're at That Chris Corbell. Perfect. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Chris Corbell.
It's 1987. I am sitting in the seminar room of the theater department of my college. I'm a junior in college, surrounded by my fellow classmates who are theater majors and English majors. I am neither. I am a government pre-law. I am the son of an attorney. I am the grandson of an attorney. And I will be honest with you, there is only one reason why I'm in this class. And that is because the professor has told me that if you write a full-length play, whether it is good, whether it is terrible, you will get a B. And this is the deal, folks. I have too much time. I don't have enough time to do anything but work on my real major and get in one easy grade. So that's why I'm here. And I'm looking around, and these people here, they're influenced by Neil Simon, and they're influenced by Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams and Wendy Wasserstein. And then they ask me, well, what is your influence? And my influence is The Odd Couple. Now, to be clear, not Neil Simon, the playwright, but The Odd Couple, the TV show that was really popular back in the day about these two mismatched guys, one was slob and the other one not a slob, and how they have to live together.
Yeah, Jack Klugman and
Tony Randall.
Tony Randall.
There's some people who are listening who probably have never heard of this, or they watched it with Matthew Perry and the guy from The State. So I don't know where in the world of time you are, but it was a TV show, it was a sitcom, and here's the deal. I had, just that summer, lived with a good friend of mine, and we had a crazy summer because he ended up sleeping with a girl I had a crush on, but I got revenge by beating him at Trivial Pursuit. And here's the thing. I remember very distinctly, but I don't know exactly when, in middle school or high school, but I remember learning that all you ever have to do to write is just write what you know. So I know that, that experience, I'm just going to write what I know. I'm assuming all these other people must know what it's like to be Tennessee Williams or David Mamet, but all I know is this. So every time I come to class, I just write one scene about that summer. And to be really clear, it's kind of like a court document where it's just literally a verbatim of what we said or did. Mm-hmm. And I can tell, because I'm not a government, because I am a government major, there's a little bit of a bias against me. But the professor, God love him, he says, Chris, you have a natural ear for dialogue. And I'm like, yes, this is great. And everyone else kind of looks at me like, yeah, good guy, good job. Except for this one girl. Her name is Sage. And Sage gives me, she gives me this very confused look. Now, Sage wears a beret. She smokes French cigarettes. And she's the worst kind of pretentious artist. She's the kind with talent. Mm. And she's the only one person I know who's really as pretentious as Sage, and that is my buddy, Tom, who I'm writing a play about. And shockingly enough, within less than 4 weeks into the new term, at a foreign film festival, they meet, they hook up, and they start dating. And it's weird, because just around the time they start dating, Sage is asking me all these questions about my characters, like, as if they were real people, like their motivations and backstories, which is kind of cool. I never really thought of them as people in that sense, but okay. So I keep on telling her, and I'm writing, and I'm doing well. And then a few more weeks in, I'm having lunch with my buddy Tom, and he says to me, hey, here's an interesting thing about Tom. I forgot to mention, because this is the 80s. There was a band called Black Flag, mm-hmm. and there was a guy named Henry Rollins, and he would talk like this. And Tom was a humongous fan of Henry Rollins. So Tom decided his entire personality would just be borrowed from Henry Rollins. So I'm going to right now sound like Henry Rollins as bad as I can, because I don't do voices, but he would be like, hey, Chris, I hear you're writing a play about me. And I go, no, I'm not. He said, that's okay. I hear I come off like a ladies' man. I'm like, I am not writing a play about you, Tom. It's about two guys, one of whom is named Todd, and the other one whose name is Chuck. And that is when I get to that, Oh, of course. Sage has told him about this. Now, thankfully, we haven't gotten up to the part where I beat him at Trivial Pursuit. But still, this kind of is bugging me out. Because here's the deal. I can totally tell honest stories about honest things as long as there's no one else in the room who knows what I'm talking about. I'm not here to write a confessional on, my friend. So I do the only thing I can do, which is I stop going to class. And now, as the weeks go by, I am in danger of failing the easiest class to pass in my university. Until finally, I hit a breaking point, and I realize I have to do the thing I do not want to do, but I must. I'm going to have to make something up. So the next day, I come to class, and I write a two-page scene that is either going to be at the middle of the play, or the beginning of the play, or the end of the play. I don't know, but it goes like this. Interior, night. We see Todd and Chuck sitting apart on a couch, many beer cans between them. Todd. Hey, man, I'm dating this new girl. Chuck. Hey, that sounds cool. How's it going? Todd. We're having sex. Chuck gets up off the couch, says to Todd, does she know about your secret? Todd gets off the couch, grabs Chuck by the collar and says, no, she doesn't. And you better not tell her. All women are skanks and they get what they deserve. Now promise me, dude man, you won't say anything. He releases the collar of Chuck. Chuck walks all the way to the front of the stage, spotlight on Chuck, and he says, fine, dude man, I won't, but she should really know you have mononucleosis. End of scene. Now, the professor who's been so good to me up until this point is not. He is not happy. He doesn't think it sounds authentic. He doesn't understand how this ended up in this. He's just not happy.
Yeah.
And everybody else I can see is now looking at me like, huh, that government major, what does he know about theater? Everybody is giving me that look, except for Sage. Once again, I've gotten that weird, benevolent, confused look from her that I got from the beginning of the class. But you know what? I don't care. Because at that point, now, I can just finish the rest of the play, and I do, and I get it in a week before class even ends. I'm going to have my grade. And I'm just now studying for something else. There's a knock at the door, and it's my buddy Tom, and Tom is so mad at me. I'm like, Tom, what's up? He said, I just came back from a clinic. I had to get tested because Sage thought that mono was code for everything and anything under the sun, which I thought was pretty funny because after all, Tom here is a neat freak. That's why I made him the Felix. But then no one would know that but me, I guess. Anyway, he's upset. I apologize. He leaves. And it hits me. Something I wrote destroyed the sex lives of two people. I had wanted to be an attorney because I thought attorneys, they had an impact on the world. But no attorney could do this. And in that moment, I realized I was going to become a playwright.
That's so funny. So they really did split? You know those people and they split? Are they just...
They didn't split. She just made him get attested before they could have sex again.
Yeah.
So he could prove that he was clean.
That's so funny.
They did split eventually, though.
They did.
I mean, I guess so maybe it's possible that was why they split.
How long was the play?
Play was about an hour and a half.
That's a long time.
It is a long time.
And so you were basically initially writing dialogue from what you heard around you?
Yeah, I just literally wrote exactly what happened as I remembered it happening in the way that it happened.
Yeah.
As if it was a sitcom. So in that sense, it was a little bit like, oh, you know, in sitcoms, things go wrong, so I'll remember to have things go wrong.
That's interesting. So yeah, it's like a different perspective. And so then did you get an A?
I did get an A, actually. Yeah. In fact, I took it again, and
I got the same class
with the same professor, so that I could write another play.
But wait a minute, was it like you could take it more than once and get another three credits?
You could take it Yes, I guess so. I took it the following year again because I had a great time doing it. And
yeah, but usually in college you have to take, you know, different classes. You can't just take it again. I'm thinking about money. I'm thinking about money because each class...
Theater department of my college allowed me to take the same class twice.
Well, again, it is a theater degree.
I mean, that's up to them. I don't know what their scam was.
So what did you tell your parents when you said you're not going to be in government pre-law?
My mom was really good about it. My father had passed away, but yeah, I think, you know, because she had been married to an attorney and she saw how much hard work it is to be an attorney.
Yeah.
And I did grow up in New York City where there is a lot of theater and there are people who are playwrights. It's not like a, you know, coal mining town.
Yeah, it wasn't as foreign.
You grow up on the Upper West Side of New York, you're going to hit a playwright, an actor, or director.
Well, you're fortunate in that respect. That's an interesting childhood. I mean, that
it's a warped childhood.
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, at least you saw people in the industry. I mean, my daughter has that. She knows what I do. She knows what her dad does, and so she knows that, you know, and she knows actresses and filmmakers, and so yeah, she sees how attainable it is. And I guess in most parts of the country, it's like that now, just because the hard or the software that you need is so like. At a consumer level, a lot of people are making films. Yes?
Yes, exactly. Or podcasts or
whatever.
Whatever it is.
Yeah,
we're living in a world of art.
Yeah.
Art on demand.
Which is so great. Which is so great. So what did you do after that?
I went to graduate school for playwriting.
So right then, the very next year, you just took that class again and then you dropped. Did you go to your supervisor or whoever or your advisor and just say, I'm not going to be pre-law anymore?
No, you know, it was interesting. My college, once I got out of college, literally about maybe just a few months after I got out of college, I started to apply to grad school. I didn't have enough time to apply to grad school while I was in college. And again, I went to a liberal arts college where everyone could just major in whatever they liked. And then at the end of the day, they could figure out what they wanted to do when they got out.
So a lot of people have the degree that you have, a Master of Arts, right? Master of Arts, is that the...
Master of Arts in Playwriting.
In Playwriting. And a lot of people probably, you know, it could be like a joke in a way, like, and look what I'm doing or something like that. But you're actually making a living.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because that transferred over into public speaking. And, you know, that's the realistic version of playwriting. It is amusing to me that I was always battling with whether or not you, as an artist, tell the truth or tell what fascinates you or make things up that you imagine. And you can do all of the above. But yeah, in public speaking, that's really about getting people to speak the truth of the heart.
Yeah. Do you have to make people cry in order to make, you know, have a good speech?
No, nor do you have to even make people laugh. All you really have to do is share your truth. If you can share your truth honestly, if you can connect with just one person when you're speaking and say the thing that is the most important thing, you can never really say all the things you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to just get down to the essence of what you feel.
Is that in a play as well then?
Absolutely.
When you write a play?
Yeah. It's when you, there's a journey you go on when you're working with actors and a director, getting to the truth of the moment.
Yeah. And so what's your most, what play that, because you've written several plays, which one are you most proud of?
I think whatever I'm working on next is
bullshit,
the thing I'm.
Man.
No,
come
it's not. It's true.
You know, if you
can,
have
can I tell you why?
If you
I'll
have
tell
to
you.
Hand a sample I will tell. In, what
I will
you
tell
said?
You. Well, it depends. If someone wants a drama or someone wants a comedy,
I see.
Then I have dramas that are like, this is going to really make you upset. This is really going to make you laugh.
I see.
But if you ask me, you know, I don't go back and after a few years and rewrite something I wrote because it's like that's a photograph of where I was at an artist at that point in my life, and
yeah.
I do get it. Why artists always love their newest work, because their newest work, whether the audience can get it or not, that's where their head is at today.
Yeah.
And I really feel like as an artist, you're in this constant communication with your audience to say, hey, folks, here's what I think and feel today.
Yeah. And, you know, that's so true because I did stand-up comedy for about 4 or 5 years in the late 90s. And then once I started working more, I just got away from it. I didn't do any stand-up for like 15 years. And now about a year ago, I got back into it. And there is one joke that has survived the entire 20 years because
yeah.
It just isn't funny anymore. You know, the stuff I wrote back then, it doesn't matter if it's full notebooks full of stuff. It's just not my point of view anymore.
Well, that's the great thing about
being
an artist.
Changes, yeah.
I think as we get older, We evolve.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's as if we became a different person.
So you do a lot of storytelling here in Los Angeles, and you're very patient, and you go to the Moth a lot.
Yes, I do. And
how do
recently I've actually gotten picked, which is blowing my mind.
Yeah, it's nice to be picked for sure. It's I find like going to the Moth, out of the 10 stories, how many do you usually enjoy?
Well, if my friends are performing, my friends are great. I love my friends.
That's true.
If my friends are not performing, maybe one.
I know.
Maybe two.
Isn't that something? It's tough, man. It's tough. I don't know. If I knew I was performing, it would be a little different. But like where I am in life, you know, with a child, I mean, there's no way I'm getting a babysitter to possibly get, you know, pay money to get in and possibly get on stage or not.
Yeah,
I
know
it's too big of a risk.
I will say I once spoke to someone who works at the Moth, and I don't want to say their name.
Yeah,
but
Gary Buckler.
I'm not going to say who it. No, it isn't. But I won't say who.
I'm kidding.
But they said to me, "There's really two kind of storytellers who do well at the Moth: performers who are just really good at performing a story, and people with a story."
Yeah.
And often I think at the Moth, I just catch the winner who is someone who's just had an amazing life experience, and that's their story.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I've seen your girlfriend, Kelly Spillman, kill at the Moth.
Yeah,
like, the audience,
we were
lost
on the same
it.
Night, and she just sweeped it, and I got swept.
Yeah,
she's
but
awesome.
But she didn't win.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And I saw her kill, and then I saw these judges, because they just choose completely random judges. They have absolutely no knowledge, and they've never even had to see the Moth before. So they just choose these random judges, and then they're like firecrackers. Like, they're just going to go off for no reason.
Well, I will say, Kelly Spillman is an amazing storyteller, and when she doesn't win, pooey on the judges at the Moth. If I don't win, maybe if you're a judge in the Moth and you're listening, okay, that's on me. But not on her. She's
a
great
storyteller.
Well, that's
what I'm saying. But I mean, I've seen that happen a dozen times. You
yeah,
know, when not the right person doesn't win.
That's true. That is really true.
So I don't know. So it's a fine line for me, the Moth. I mean, if it, you know,
it's
not like I won't do it or I won't go, but it's a very fine line. Let me tell you something. My show, Story Smash, not to compare because it's a completely different thing, but I have a game show, as you know, Story Smash.
Great show.
And the person who's supposed to win always wins. You know why? I pick good judges.
That's true. You do. And I have to say, when I was watching it, I kind of knew who was going to win.
Yeah, of course. We all know. Listen, you actually played before when your name got drawn out of the hat.
Yeah.
And you got chosen to be in the third round.
That was insane.
And that's like only maybe one or two times that's ever happened in the history of the game.
Wow. I'm flattered and honored.
But again, I pick good judges. I'm just saying it's a fair setting. All in all,
you pick great judges.
Thank you. I'm just ragging on the Moth because I'm, you know, they're just so flippin' famous now and popular, and they've got so much money running through their schools and their clubs. Everything's going on for them, and I'm just a little bit, you know, envious.
I hear you, but I got to keep on going up, so I don't want to alienate. So if you're listening and you eventually become a Moth judge and you get a chance to give me a 10 score,
I'll do that.
Please,
you know I will, because
do,
you're my
folks.
Friend.
And I'm not just saying just for you, Christine. Everyone listening, if you ever see me on the stage, please, all I need in this life is your validation. So please, like a 9.9.
Okay. Give us, and then we're going to wrap it up. Give us 3 or 5 tips on how to tell a good speech or how to tell a good story even.
You know what? They're almost identical.
Yeah.
Speak from the heart. Think about what you're saying. If you can cut it out, don't say it. Say as little as possible. If these were your last words, what would you say? And even in writing, you know, if you only have 5 pages to write a scene, what is the most essential part of that scene?
Yeah.
What is the defining moment in your speech, or what is the defining moment in your story? Because every speech and every story is really about a defining moment where something happens that really affects you.
I think it takes time as well. Like, if you write a speech out or a story, you have to put it down and then come back to it the next day, because it will change. For a period of time, it's going to keep changing. So I think you should give yourself permission to, you know, first of all, brevity is really important. I mean, I would cut. You usually don't have to start at in the beginning. You can usually jump into something a lot faster.
What was that famous saying, you know, get in late and come out early?
Say that again.
Where you start your scene as late as possible and you get out of your scene as early as possible.
Interesting. So have you produced your plays here in Los Angeles?
Not in a long time. I've really just been focusing on, you know, the business, and I've also been focusing on producing and performing and storytelling.
But producing a play in Los Angeles is difficult, yes?
It's a big undertaking. I'm working on a solo piece, which will bring me back into producing a play, because solo work is kind of where theater and storytelling meet.
Well, it's hard in L.A. to do plays because it's not really a theater town. Is that true or not true?
You know, I think there's two schools of thought on that. I think that it depends. In some sense, you're right, a lot of theater in this town is just a showcase for actors. But because there are a lot of theaters in this town, you really do have the opportunity to do something really cool and interesting. And there are some people in this town. I've been to the Fringe every year for the last 5 years, and there's some beautiful work being made every year in this town.
That's nice, yeah. That's nice. It can get very expensive, you know, to rent the theater. I mean, even me doing my show at the Lyric, it's only me, but still, you know, you've got to rent the space, you've got to rent the tech person, and then you have to beg people to come, and it's very difficult to get people to come. What's your take on that?
I think it is. I think it's very hard to get people to come. But in fairness, I think that has less to do with people and more to do with the fact that successful commercial works in LA don't do very well. I just went and saw Mike Birbiglia's one-man show at the Amundsen Theater, and his face was literally plastered all over town like he was running for president.
Right.
And the theater was only at 50% capacity.
Interesting.
So I think in general, because of the presence of streaming media and movies and maybe the lack of money being put into our arts program in early education, mm-hmm. people in general are just not as motivated to go towards live performance.
Yeah,
as
that's
they used
too
to
bad.
Be.
Well, and here in LA, there's, you know, so many places to put your entertainment dollar.
Yeah.
You know, you're fighting with, you know, two basketball teams, two football teams, two baseball teams, and every single rock star comes through.
Yeah, we have too many things to do.
It's a good problem, man.
It is.
I enjoy it. One more thing. Tell me how, like, you know, what's your suggestion to the young kids who want to be artists? What's the key? Anything? I mean, follow your passion and all that, but what about, like, you know, money?
Well, you know, if you can find a good paying day job, or if you can find a good paying job that you can do simultaneously mm-hmm. with your art, if that makes you, say, an entrepreneur or a freelancer, or you know, there's a lot of great attorneys who also happen to be great writers. You have to, everyone's story is a different story.
Yeah.
And in the time that I've been here, I've watched some people become very wealthy in the arts, supremely wealthy. We both know these people who, when they came here, they're like, how is that person going to make it? And that person's now like a multimillionaire.
Who? Tell me who.
I'll tell you after the show, because I do not want to knock on famous people.
Yeah.
Because I want to work in this town. But so if you're listening, if this is the thing you want to do with your life, do it.
Yeah.
If you lose interest, walk away. If you regain interest, come back.
I hear you, man. I hear you. It's all a process.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Find Chris over there on Twitter at ThatChrisCorbell. And you can find me over there as well at Storyworthy. You know that. And don't forget to head over to ChristineBlackburn.com. That has all the upcoming shows. That's my point. I've been doing Flappers quite a bit lately. So hopefully you guys, if you're in town, catch me there. It's a lot of fun.
It's a great venue. They have wonderful food.
Yeah, they really do. I eat there a lot.
I mean, that's the nice thing about Flappers. Also, the Improv, too, is that these are places where you don't have to just order two drinks. You can order as much food as you like.
I love that. The food at the Improv is good.
Yeah,
right.
They are. It's good food.
Well, there you go. We just pitched those guys. Aren't we nice? All right, you guys. I want to thank you so much again for tuning in. On behalf of the very talented Chris Corbell, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.